The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, September 17th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, editor, the Jacobin magazine, Bhaskar Sunkara on the Socialist Manifesto. Meanwhile, day two of a massive UAW strike against GM, and 80,000 Kaiser Permanente workers planned to strike in October. Meanwhile, Trump's National Labor Relations Board's second attempt at rolling back worker protections from franchisees thwarted again. North Carolina Democrats sell out everybody except for them exact selves. Trump calls it Saudi 9/11, and the Pentagon says, whoa, 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 whoa. Ayanna Pressley to introduce Kavanaugh impeachment resolution in the House today. The Manhattan DA subpoenas Trump's tax returns in the hush money payoff scandal. Elizabeth Warren draws 20,000 in New York, and a dubious WFP endorsement. And the acting head of the Directorate of National Intelligence has until today to turn over that compelling whistleblower report as mandated by law. We're just going to have to testify in front of Congress on Thursday. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Tuesday. Welcome. Everybody's here. You will notice that we have a Chiron on our show today, reminding all of you that October 11th, right? Is that the date? October 11th?
I believe so. Let me double check that and also make the Chiron.
Oh, okay. I guess that fell through the cracks. That the registration deadline for New York State is imminent.
Yep. October 11th.
October 11th. And so if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, you need to register if you're not already registered as a Democrat. Always also a good idea just to call your local board of electors and say, hey, am I registered? And just confirm you may be your polling place.
Should definitely do that. Also, New York is super weird and very funky in terms of things. So basically, it's register by the 11th if you're voting for Sanders. If you're voting for anyone else, it's the 15th. I don't know why that is, but just so everybody knows.
Classic.
There is actually, I believe, a bill.
Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, Cuomo's. It was good. It was. Well, I was going for voter fraud, not a cheap punchline. But Andrew Cuomo is holding up a bill that I think would expend, that would give another several months, if I'm not mistaken.
I wouldn't doubt it. He was talking about trying to, at one point he was contemplating rolling up the primary and making it happen in February, as opposed to, I think, it's April now. Now, it may seem ridiculous to you. Why would you need to register by October 11th if the election, I believe, is around April 11th? And you would say to yourself, don't they have the technology? Like, how slow are these computers that have the voter rolls? Does it really take 6 months for it to catch up? No, it doesn't. I mean, that's the New York for a long, long time has been somewhat corrupt in that way. And we see this also. I mean, frankly, this is something that is just intrinsic in many respects to politicians. You know, we were talking about Nancy Pelosi's refusal to sort of unleash impeachment. And in many respects, you know, that sort of iron law of institute, you know, people will want to protect their power in an institution even more than the institution's power. And in North Carolina, the state Senate and House have both voted on new lines for districts. As you recall, a Superior Court in North Carolina found that the districts were unconstitutionally, state constitution, gerrymandered. And I think the Republicans decided not to fight it because they also probably had wind of the fact that their boy Hofstetter or Hofletter or whatever that guy's name was, who was the grandfather of gerrymandering and died, and his
Hofeller
and his daughter found all his records on his computer. They voted on new lines. They have to reconcile them between the two houses. But as far as I can tell from following some local North Carolina reporters, one is Stephen Wolf, and the other is a guy named Will Duran, who's half of North Carolina Senate Dems largely voted for the Republicans' new, modestly less gerrymandered map, likely in part because some Dems got favorable seats to protect. And put more explicitly by Duran, the real message coming from North Carolina's Democratic state Senate leader is that they'd prefer their own seats remain safe, even if it means the entire map still has gerrymandering to favor Republicans. Putting themselves before their party and their voters.
Trash.
Yeah, I mean, it's this is a problem with human beings, frankly, in my opinion.
Hashtag not all human beings.
Not all human beings are bad people. Let's put it that way. But
problem with the Democratic Party.
I mean, they're not doing a favor for the Democratic Party. I mean,
No. You're misunderstanding me. There's too many people inside the Democratic Party that center their own immediate interest over any type of broader strategy.
Yes. I suspect that that is...
it's not unique to it. But
it's not unique to the Democratic Party.
But I do think there's less of a culture of that right now in the Republican Party, as an example.
Oh, I think that's absolutely
the case.
It's not unique,
but it is a problem too.
They have... I think that tends to be when there's more money, frankly, involved. People tend to go along much more. There's a lot less independence in some respect. And by independence, I mean both in a good and bad way, in the sense that, like, I'm going to protect myself if there's not the same amount of resources that I can get by going along. So it is indeed a problem, though. Bad. Very bad.
Not good. Very bad for you.
All right, but some good news. Well, not. I don't know if it's good. Oh, we'll get to the UAW strike in a bit. I mean, we're in day two. My understanding is, well, let me just read this, and then we'll do the UAW strike video, because this is apropos of the interview we did with Wrecked over vacation, which, if you did not listen to it, about this book, about the demise of the U.S. car industry, and their demise as a function of their attempting to diminish worker power. Just, I want to read from this Reuters report. It's talking about some 50,000, almost 50,000 U.S. hourly workers at GM, represented by the UAW, went on strike not last night, but the night before. And there were reports that GM knew this was coming, so they were stashing essentially their high-margin vehicles all around the country. They had a lot of inventory preparing for this. And in that that book, Wrecked, they talked about how the entire supply chain for GM and Ford and Chrysler at the time was changed so that it would not rely or did not empower workers to go on strike very easily. And if you stockpile inventory, you stockpile parts, you stockpile, et cetera, you are less subjected to the power of the labor. And much of this is about GM hiring temporary workers.
I believe they're called scabs.
Well, no. This scabs would be people who are crossing a picket line. But I'm talking about in the course of their doing business. There are workers who are full-time workers working across the conveyor belt or whatever it is, the who are doing the exact same thing they're doing, except for they are there as temporary workers so that GM can pay them less, provide them less benefits, diminish the power of labor, right? Because if you have somebody there who's temporary in terms of status, the cost of them involved in any type of labor action is less. And this Reuters says U.S. automakers use temporary employees who are paid less and receive fewer benefits to be more cost competitive versus their Asian and European counterparts with non-unionized plants in the U.S. South. And the fact is, I just don't believe this. I mean, just based upon that that book, that I think part of it is they want to also diminish the power of the full-time workers, the non-temporary workers, and their ability also to increase their wages. So this isn't just a question of we save money on the temporary workers. It is we use the temporary workers to undercut the power of all our workers.
Yeah, that's interesting, because another thing that they're mad about is a two-tier contract. So workers who are not temporary are still paid less than the senior workers who might even do the exact same job. And this is a kind of contract that is obviously terrible for worker solidarity, and it's one that the union accepted.
Indeed. Now, one of the other issues for these workers is that back in 2009, the unions really took a hit in helping salvage this company, particularly GM, but others. They allowed for lapsed payments in retirement funds and in healthcare funds, et cetera, et cetera. So here is a clip of some workers speaking out on CNN.
Is it that you all want?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey, great to see you. What do you want? Can you encapsulate it in a couple of sentences of why you're striking?
Yeah, just improvements on wages, healthcare benefits, and profit sharing across the board. A lot of things that we sacrificed back during the recession in 2007, 2008, we want to be compensated for now as the company is making record-breaking profits.
And so, Ray, you also, as I understand it, are a single dad. And so what time did you show up? What time did you have to show up today to strike?
6 a.m.
Okay. And so tell me the effect that this is having on your home and your life.
Well, being a father, the healthcare benefits are tremendously important, and trying to survive off of a reduced income is very difficult. So going back to work and with a fair wage is very important for all of us, you know, company-wide.
As we understand it, this is just this morning. There are still dozens of sticking points. How does that make you both feel?
Yeah. For me personally, I understand the difficulty of the negotiations and the importance of them. So this being a lengthy strike, I'm fine with that being the case as long as everything is ironed out and it's fair for everyone, because I understand the position of the company as well, trying to go forward and being profitable and being on the cutting edge of new technology and being the leader across the board with the auto industry. But also on the backside of that, the workers who sacrificed for the company to get ahead today and be profitable as it is today, we want to be compensated as well, because we took a major sacrifice over the years.
I mean, they have. They've taken a massive sacrifice.
And they consider the company's well-being.
Indeed.
Even as the company
screws them over
in every way. Yes.
Yeah. Well, they still need the company for jobs.
Yes.
Of course. But it's a mentality difference that's quite striking.
Like car. I mean, you know, I've because of my my in-laws, former in-laws and their families. I knew quite a few of those folks who had worked for Ford and GM and this and that, and the pride that they take in their work is pretty intense. In that, it's not. I think folks work with, you know, in constructing things like that. There tends to be a very high level of pride that you don't see necessarily, when you go into like, I work for an accounting firm or something like that.
Yeah, they're making things. It's productive. It's literally productive labor. And they did a hard picket, by the way. Like, you saw some people walking around in the background of that video, just doing what you might normally think of as a picket line. But they also did a hard picket where they physically blocked people from getting into the building, which is how picket lines started. And I think that's pretty cool. We haven't seen that in a while.
I have a feeling we're going to see more of it as we go. In the meantime, if you're busy, if you're walking a picket line, for that matter, why not walk a picket line? If you're at, by all means, go out and walk a picket line with, you will be, more than welcomed. And what better thing to do while you're walking a picket line is also then you could literally, like, read a nonfiction book. How? Blinkist. It's an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed down to 15 minutes. You can either read it or you can listen to it. Both on the app. Blinkist is super unique. It works on your phone. It works on your tablet. Works on your computer, of course. You'll find everything from, like, health, health books, how-to books, some history books. Elizabeth Colbert's The Sixth Extinction's on there. And now that I'm done with my Civil War podcast, I'm all over that. Tried to get her on for the show for that. Couldn't get her on for whatever reason a long time ago. But The Sixth Extinction, of course, I talk about that Tim Ferriss 4-Hour Work Week, which I listen to. But I also saw the 80-20 principle, which Tim Ferriss first introduced me to. There's a whole book on it.
I'm striking and listening to Tim Ferriss.
And it's 16 minutes. It'll take for you to listen to it. Also, and I may go back. I haven't. It was probably, I don't know how many years ago it was that I read A Brief History of Time. Well, you have 21 minutes. You get to all the key takeaways on it.
I have all the time.
All the time would be yours. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, and all for one low price. And right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Try it for free for 70 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority. Start your 7-day free trial. Look at this. Look at some more they have. Getting Things Done, The Power of Habits, Factfulness, 10 Reasons Why We're Wrong About the World. Yeah, and why things are better than you think. Fire and Fury, all that. Check it out. Blinkist.com/majority. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Bhaskar Sankara on his book, The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. Be right back.
Oh, yeah. Ah, Y'all be thinking, nude is the brand new young. Everybody's just drinking, inhibitions just gone.
You don't need to be rude, you don't need to be wild. Whatever you do, no compromise and done with style. The gold standard, crazy, amazing.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the editor of Jacobin Magazine, author of The Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality, Bhaskar Sankara. Welcome to the back to the program.
Yeah, it's been a while. Thank you for having me on, and I hope everything's going well on your end.
Things are going fairly well here, all things considered, so I appreciate it. Sorry we couldn't get you into studio. I have a feeling you're probably calling from around the corner, but
I'm actually in D.C. today, it makes sense. But I'm normally either in my apartment or my office in New York, which is the only two places where people can find me.
All right. Well, I understand that dynamic very much, actually. Next time. But all right, let's get into this. It's a good time to get into it because right now we're looking at what appears to be a three-way race in the Democratic Party. One of those candidates, I would contend, is leaking oil, as they say. And, that is always a problem. There are two other candidates in there that I think it may let me put it this way, who represent two options for the left. But there is a distinction and we will get to that. But let's start with this. The difference between a democratic socialist and a social democrat. What are the difference between those two things?
Okay, well, I think I'm going to preempt your question somewhat by saying that I don't think that Elizabeth Warren, though she is a progressive, is necessarily either. But in my definition, a social democrat, or at least what social democracy has become, is about trying to implement doses of socialism within capitalism. It's about creating certain bedrock social safety net programs for people. It's about, in other words, making life less captive to the tyranny of the market. So you have universal health care, you have child care, you have all these other demands. I think democratic socialists believe in all those things, but we want to go a little bit further. We also want to question the inequity and power that we think stem from the workplace and from the fact that capitalists run workplace like dictatorships, and this power and this wealth that they accumulate in these workplaces bleeds over into our social and political spheres as well. So if I was to do a very forced, very awkward sports analogy, since it's the beginning of football season, I know as good progressives, we don't really like the NFL, but, social democracy is getting the ball to within field goal range. Democratic socialism is scoring a touchdown. It's figuring out how can we actually create a society in which we're not dependent on capitalists to create the goods and services that we then will tax to profits that we then would tax to fund our welfare state.
So if I understand you, the problem with allowing capitalists, broadly speaking, to remain intact is that there is a tendency that they will turn that capital. We will go from plutonomy into a plutocracy in some respects.
Yeah, that's essentially what it means is that even if they'll agree to our demands today, if we have a large movement and we have a mass strike wave with all these other things going on, what happens 20 years, 30 years down the road? As soon as the opportunity strikes, capitalists are going to find ways to roll back key parts of the welfare state. We saw this in Sweden. We've seen this time and time again, that when we try to administer these reforms, but we don't challenge this control and this power that capital has, they'll find ways to roll back the welfare state. So I think for now, we should all be united, those of us left of center, in fighting for the really important demands that will help people day to day. Medicare for all, decent jobs for all, child care, making sure our children have access to nutrition, housing, all these things are things we can agree on. But I think fundamentally the way we go about fighting for these things is either going to be in a way that's confrontational, that recognizes that even though in the short term we're going to have to make compromises, we ultimately are going up against an enemy that doesn't want to compromise with us, and as soon as they got the upper hand, they'll undermine us. Or we'll do it in a kind of technocratic piecemeal mode that doesn't really recognize that we're in a battle to the death as far as our enemies are concerned. So as Bernie sometimes likes to put it, there has been class war for the last 30, 40 years in this country in a really vicious way. The only thing, it's been a one-sided class war. What we're proposing is that working people have distinct interests from the interests of our bosses, and we need to figure out a way to organize and fight for things together.
I mean, to a certain, it does, you cite Sweden in the book as an example of sort of these reversals, and go through the history of different, I guess you call socialist projects. Would you say that that turn that did take place in the, maybe let's call it, just peg it to the 70s in this country after, what people call the Great Compression, was in part a good illustration of what happens when you don't fundamentally undermine capitalism or capitalists within society in terms of like maintaining to the extent that it was not necessarily shared broadly, because huge sectors of our society were denied this, but to the extent that it existed, that the worker benefits and middle class, what they enjoyed was then basically slowly taken away.
Yeah, I think a lot of what we got in the 40s, 50s, 60s, this was just the result of an environment in which there was kind of a growth liberalism. So the economy is growing so fast that capital didn't want any disruptions, so they could break off pieces of the pie to labor. But as soon as they entered any sort of economic difficulties like they did in the 70s and early 80s, then they basically were like, well, this arrangement that was working when our profit rates were this high is no longer working for us anymore. So sometimes when we think about neoliberalism, let's say, we think of it in two ideological terms, like the neoliberalism is just this idea that was conjured up in some room by Milton Friedman, a bunch of other odious guys in the Chicago School. But in fact, what neoliberalism is, what the era that we've been living in for the last 20, 30 years, it's just capitalism getting its groove back. It's just, the reassertion of capital saying we need to be flexible enough to restructure and deregulate and not have to deal with union interference. But this so-called interference is the only thing that was making sure that some of this growth and some of this tremendous wealth in our society was in fact trickling down to working people. So in the short term, a lot of what we need to do is not just support one presidential candidate or not just support one issue demand like Medicare for All in isolation, but to connect these things with a broader struggle to repoliticize our civil society, to get to the point where you could talk to your friends, your neighbors, your family about politics, get to the point where we have big union drives in this country, get to the point where we have civic assemblies, things like Occupy, but more permanent, where we could really think of ourselves as not just passive consumers, but producers and political agents and citizens. And I think in a small part, this is some of the promise of the Sanders campaign. Not all of it is realized, but at least it gets people to thinking about politics and thinking that, all these things happening in my life that I think of as individual failings, that I think of as just kind of calamities that I'm suffering from in isolation, are in fact related to social problems. And these social problems have collective solutions beyond just individual grit and kind of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
I want to just to stay for a moment in terms of where social Democrats, Democratic socialists and social Democrats, where they sort of, it's not so much that they part ways on a highway, if you use that metaphor, but one goes further. When do you cross that threshold? Like to what extent? Like at what point do you and I know this is pretty theoretical stuff that we're talking about, but at what point is capital undermined enough so that they don't have the ability to reverse gains that have been made?
So let's look historically. I think it's a really, really good question. But let's look historically at our kind of archetype for social democracy, the country where it was most successful. In Sweden, the Social Democrats emerged as a force in the early 1900s, and initially in the early decades, they're fighting for political democracy because Sweden was quite a vicious, oligarchical, anti-democratic country. And once they win political suffrage and rights for this mass of working people that they're representing, then they begin the construction of social democracy, and they rule virtually uninterrupted from the 1930s until the mid to late 1970s, until 1976. And you see that in the first 40s, in the 1940s and the 1950s, this is times of consolidation of, you know, Swedish capital growing, but a lot of this wealth coming down to workers. You see the beginnings of the construction of a welfare state to the point that at least your core necessities of life, you were no longer dependent on the market, even though it was fundamentally driven by a capitalist market economy. And these social goods were dependent on taxation from capital. And what people on the far left, what Leninists thought looking at social democracy was that, well, obviously they could see some of the good in it. They could see that people's lives were getting better. But one of their main criticisms was, well, essentially you're buying off workers. You are taking workers, you're making them, you know, live a cushier life, but you're tying them real close to the success of their firms and also to the state. And they thought this would be conservatizing. But in fact, what we discovered in the history of social democracy, or at least in the Swedish case, was that winning more demands didn't make people more complacent. It caused them to demand more. And, you know, a simple illustration of this is just the fact, let's say both me and you, Sam, are unemployed, and I'm unemployed in an area with 20% local unemployment, and you're unemployed in an area with virtually full employment, you know, 2, 3% unemployment. Who's going to be, let's say you're employed in that environment. Who's going to be more apt to go to their boss and to demand a raise? Or to potentially get together with your colleagues and risk going on strike? Obviously, it's going to be the person in the environment with lower unemployment. In the same way, in Sweden, workers had gotten so much rights, they've gotten so much security from this welfare state, that by the late 60s, by 1967, 1968, you see mass strike waves across Sweden, but strikes that are demanding not just better wages and conditions, but strikes that are demanding industrial democracy. They start, in other words, to question the right of management to manage. And this is really kind of a fundamental step in the direction of democratic socialism, in questioning not just redistributive outcomes, but questioning the very game itself. And throughout the 1970s, as Swedish capital descends into crisis because of a variety of reasons, this worldwide slump that happened in a lot of Western countries, Swedish capitalists, who before in the 1950s and 60s could say, well, listen, I'm getting less money, I'm taxed more, I'm regulated more, I have to deal with powerful unions compared to my fellow capitalists in, say, France or Britain, but unlike them, I have industrial peace. You know, the workers are happy enough that they're not going on strike, so at least whatever returns I'm getting is predictable returns. Now we're saying, well, I have to deal with a restless workforce, and my profitability is down, and I have to deal with all these international stuff going on, like the globalization of the economy, like the OPEC shock, and so on. And then they say, well, this arrangement that's working for us is no longer working. And they have this ability to withhold investment. So sometimes when we think about the power of capital, we think in really dramatic terms. We think about the coup of Allende in Chile in 1973. We think about even capital flight, you know, capitalists just leaving whole locations. But the way that capitalists more often than not exert their power on even center-left governments, even very good progressive governments, is by saying, we are no longer going to invest unless you make the so-called business environment more favorable, which means, in other words, unless you do let us do what we want to do. And fundamentally, there was a few different responses to this. On the right wing of social democracy, the third way social democrats, as they later became called, people like Schroeder and Gordon Brown, and, you know, he was always worse than the rest of them, but Tony Blair, you could throw in this you know, group of people too. Their gambit was, we're going to let capital do what it wants. We're going to let capital deregulate. We're going to weaken the unions, weaken our very social base that gets us elected. But in return, in this environment of renewed growth, we're going to tax this renewed growth, and we're going to use this taxation money to fund the key parts of our welfare state. We're going to keep the NHS. We're going to keep, you know, all these other kind of key parts of the welfare state provisioning. That was the gamble of third way social democracy. We're going to retreat, you know, down, you know, maybe 50 steps, but we're going to make sure that we don't retreat all the way to the bottom. And that's the only way we'll preserve some gains that we have made in the past. On the left wing of social democracy, though, we said, well, maybe there's a way, instead of retreating down those 50 steps, where we could charge up to the roof of the system. And the charge was done, you know, proposed in its most ambitious form by something called the MITRE plan, which would have slowly over time transferred ownership of Swedish companies to the people who work there, to the workers, because workers don't flee. There's no capital flight from your own community. If your job and your ownership is tied with your community, worker controlled, or in this case, a workplace controlled by these collective funds, wouldn't just refuse to invest. You know, they would have a very different set of incentives.
Well, they're literally already invested in that community. I mean, that they don't have the ability. They don't have access to the means of which, you know, to find another one, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, in this kind of firm, your mentality would also completely change too, because your goal is not to maximize your total profits, but you're rather maximize your profit for worker. So some of the imperatives of capitalism, the imperative of having to constantly expand its scale in the same way just to accumulate this vast amount of profits that's not reinvested into communities but rather hoarded by a few people. You know, these dynamics change. I mean, in my vision of a socialist society, there's still a market economy in a certain sphere, and firms still compete, and, you know, inefficient firms go away. But there's also a difference between, you know, being in an inefficient firm that's outcompeted and landing on a cushy welfare state and getting retrained and going to another sector than what happens today, which is, you know, you get laid off of your job and you have unemployment benefits for a few weeks, and they make you feel degraded. They make you feel terrible when you're taking it. And, you know, then your unemployment benefits and your COPA is up and you're, you know, out of luck, right? So in other words, though, with social democracy, there were alternatives. The right-wing kind of solution to the crisis of social democracy was pursued, but in my view, there was always a left-wing alternative, and you saw it being attempted in fits and starts. But our premise is this: we go to what we know works. We know that social democracy works. From there, we have an inkling about some of the pressures, some of the contradictions of social democracy that we'll run into. Then from there, we need to go beyond social democracy. But day-to-day, this is kind of in the future, but day-to-day, the main difference between a social democrat and a democratic socialist is, to some degree, how do you want to fight for these things that we both agree that we need in our society? Do we fight for universal health care by sitting down at the table and making a compromise with key business leaders and the health insurance companies and whatnot? Do we fight through class struggle, through a march on Washington, through all these other kind of methods? And to me, even though someone like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn, you could even say, has a program, a set of demands that's fundamentally social democratic, they're going about fighting for these demands through class struggle. And that's a key distinction for me. You know, I don't care what you call yourself. You call yourself progressive, you call yourself a democratic socialist, a social democrat, or whatever. If you're willing to struggle with working people and take on the powerful interests that are keeping us down, then you know, I'm with you. That's the most important thing.
And so, as we, the idea is that that mode of operation is going to set you up to diminish capital's power so that they don't have the ability in leaner times to essentially take it out of to externalize those costs onto workers, essentially, and to rest in society.
Yes, exactly.
So do you have a sense? I mean, as you go forward in, you know, if that other path had been taken, let's say, and presumably that other path was not pursued because of the political power of capital that they have as a function of having the capital. And so do you have a sense, I guess it was still like, at what point, how much gets you to a point of equilibrium? Because I guess when I contemplate, I mean, I guess I am of just sort of philosophically speaking, sort of convinced that a certain amount of tension is always necessary, right? To just maintain some measure of tension. And is there a concern that, like, you, I mean, is there an idea, even a theoretical concept of, like, if 40% of businesses or certain industries are essentially worker owned, you've achieved you've crossed a threshold where capital simply doesn't have the power.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Is there kind of a tipping point here where we are in a different sort of society? Well, I would say that the kind of changes that we need to implement would be gradual but sectoral. So in other words, all right, let's talk about at the beginning, it'll be decommodifying key parts of the economy. So we could imagine, indeed, you know, we both are kind of fighting for in the next 5 years, decommodifying the healthcare sector.
Right.
So in this case, it's a gradual reform in the context of the whole economy, though within the sector of the health insurance business, it's quite, you know, drastic. Of course, there'll be a just transition for the working people that are in this sector trying to support themselves and their families, but it'll be kind of a big change in that sector. We can imagine that applying to other of these key sectors that we don't think should be dependent on your ability to pay, that we don't think the market has a big role, should have a role in. There are certain, you know, things that are in any, even a, you know, a capitalist economist would admit, you know, these are natural monopolies. There's no need for competition. In fact, the state should just as well, you know, take it over. So, you know, I think that's a key.
What are those sectors? If you were to tick them off, I mean, I imagine that you have your secret list of sectors that you're going to take over one at a time.
I think that things like having our transport sector, like when it comes to our national rail lines and things like that, being actually run by the government. You know, right now you have a little bit of government ownership in some of the Northeast, via a complicated relationship with Amtrak's a very confusing organization, but you have some level of state direction and control and investment and execution. In other parts of the country, you absolutely do not. If anyone's ever been on the West Coast, sitting and waiting behind a fracking truck and sitting in an Amtrak, which has to sit for like 2 hours while cargo passes by, you know, you would know what I mean. Other sectors, like obviously healthcare is one that I mentioned, telecommunications. You know, there's certain sectors like that I think the state can probably do a better job at than even worker-owned firms. When it comes to other worker-owned firms, the way this legislation, I think, should be implemented would be saying, and there's proposals in this direction, they're not as ambitious in the UK right now, that firms over a certain size to begin with, let's say firms employing 50 or more people, must give kind of buybacks of equity every single year to a collective fund owned by that firm's employees. And over time, for instance, in 10, 20, 30 years, a majority of the controlling interest and therefore a majority of these boards would be run by workers. So, you know, some capitalists will go along with it to say, well, I'm still making plenty of money because essentially I'm being bought out by right. my employees. There's others that'll, you know, resist like hell. But that's what I imagine the situation being. I don't think that we could just keep the existing structure of society without legislation and just create co-ops and kind of seize of capitalism. I think we need to be pushed by legislation and by a strong labor movement. And it's some ways out, you know, but let's consider what we're talking about, a horizon and a vision of a society without class, without this distinction between management and employee and ownership that I think, as a socialist, I believe I'm normatively opposed to. You know, I believe that if we have an alternative to these extreme forms of hierarchy, that we should pursue these alternatives. And pursuing this alternative has the added benefit of securing the welfare state that I believe already in a majority of Americans think is, you know, their right as human beings, the right to a decent job, the right to health care, the right to a roof over their head. So, but as we're fighting for these things, I think we need to make clear that we're not just trying to convince people of a good vision or good argument. We are running up against people who have a vested interest in the status quo. Because there's a lot of people getting rich due to the fact that there's no rent controls and there's no we're not building public housing stock to decrease the house of the you know price of private housing stock. There's a lot of people getting rich off real estate speculation. There's a hell of a lot of people getting rich off the way that our health insurance system is run. And for the longest time in the Democratic Party, at best, candidates have been talking in technocratic terms about how to help, you know, middle class and families, as they put it. But they haven't been talking about the vested interest and the power structure against us. And it's not something that we could just wish away. So I think that's a real utility in being democratic socialist today. It's not necessarily advocating a different set of reforms in the short term. It's advocating a different means of going about and achieving these things.
Right. So first order are these material benefits, but the second order is making sure that they're sustainable, and that requires a structural change.
They're connected.
Right. Yeah.
If you can't get Medicare for all, then you're not going to be able to get you're not going to have the power to demand something like more employee control of their workplaces. You know, they're very much connected. Winning begets winning.
Many people, I think, have theorized that's basically what happened in the late 60s and 70s. At one point, like there was, at least within the context of you know, white society, people felt confident enough in their economic futures that they started to demand more political power, and that became somewhat problematic for the powers that be. Jamie, I suspect would have issue with the idea of markets continuing in that, you know, workers competing in their firms against each other could lead to their own exploitation and sort of like more, you know, we've got to hit these numbers, everybody. The workers' council has voted that we're all going to be here and we're going to be doing 10 hours a day because mm-hmm. we got to hit these numbers. I mean, what's your response
to something like that? Well, I think like? The way you solve that problem is through, you know, fair and just state regulations towards setting maximum work days, towards setting certain standards and certain that workplaces must operate within to create a competitive and fair environment. I think that's incredibly, you know, necessary. But, you know, fundamentally, I just cannot imagine if we agree that we're still in a condition of relative scarcity, which might change in the future. You know, I can't imagine a society producing efficiently without having some degree of firm failure, without pushing ourselves to innovate and to be a little bit different. And in fact, if you have a centrally planned system, if you have a system that's less efficient, what you might end up with is workers producing less efficiently in more labor-intensive ways. Why wouldn't we want a firm that is so inefficient that they're not making the right technological investments, that they're forced to work 12, 13 hours in order to stay competitive with firms that are doing things in different ways? Why would we want that latter firm to stick around? If the penalties for losing and the penalties for the people at that firm is, once again, bouncing off this cushy kind of safety net of a welfare state. So what's key to me is that socialism must represent both voice and exit for working people. So voice within your workplace, but also the ability to leave work. And so enough of society has to be outside the market. But, you know, in order to actually keep that decommodified sector of the society well-funded and humming, I do think you need some sort of productive sphere. But for me, markets have existed before capitalism,
right,
and they'll probably exist for a long time after capitalism. My problem is not necessarily the markets themselves. My problem is how the firms that are competing within the market are structured, which is as tyrannical kind of firms under capitalism, and also what the penalties for failure is. Right now it's destitution, and that's not a reasonable penalty. But for consumer goods, you know, I see no reason why there should be a state monopoly on the production of, you know, forks and knives. I think that'll bring back a lot of bad memories for people of the inefficiency and failures of planned economies in the 20th century.
I'm satisfied with that. You can go on to the Antifada and maybe continue but so let me ask you.
I would love to have you.
So, okay, but let me... all right. So let's pivot a little bit to the sort of the current day political pitch on some level. And what do you do in terms of is the project right now from your perspective to raise? And I should say that, you know, I'm very comfortable going down this road, and I'm quite convinced that I'm not I'm going to be leaving this planet before it gets anywhere where I don't feel comfortable where it is. So I'm happy to travel down that road as far as I still have the capacity to walk. So, but in the context of your project, like, what is the challenge now in terms of raising awareness? And so like to what extent, I mean, because theoretically, right, I mean, on some level, Bernie Sanders should be polling higher on some level if why isn't he, let's put it that way.
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons, one of which is that most Democrats like all the Democratic nominees. You know, people like me and you have very strong favorites, right? You know, we feel very strongly about the candidates. A lot of people are just, well, they really hate Trump, and a lot of the candidates are broadly saying the right things about social goods, and, you know, loyal Democrats just want Trump out of there.
Right.
So I think, you know, that explains why it's kind of a dead heat for these top three candidates, and Biden's the most familiar, the most connected with the very popular Obama. So, you know, he's a little bit ahead. But I think we could explain that pretty easily. I think the broader problem, the broader question of what's happening on the left, what's happening with democratic socialism, is that we're resuscitating right now, but we're coming alive as largely a media phenomenon. Don't get me wrong, there's tens of thousands of working people that are democratic socialists now that are doing great work organizing their communities, but we don't yet have the mass base of millions that we need to change this country. And that's a big challenge. How do we get more implanted and more rooted in working communities? A lot of people who are democratic socialists today are, college-educated people. A lot of them are D-class professionals that were from parents who are accountants and lawyers, and now are working working-class jobs for sure. But we are definitely drawn from a particular milieu, and in order to become a broader, more diverse, more rooted movement, we really need to win over layers of working people. And the way to do that is obviously just patient and slow organizing. There's great work being done right now in Brooklyn by DSA, connected to the Crown Heights Tenants Union, connected with these fights in New York around rent controls. There's great work being done around the country in these congressional races, which is a reason to for people just to knock on doors and to talk about your ideas and talk about politics. So there's a lot of really exciting things going on, and we just need to keep double downing on these efforts. I think we do need to be connected to Bernie 2020 and to some of the movement around Bernie Sanders and the fight for Medicare for All and so on. And all these campaigns are a way just to deepen our base, but we can't be content with just being a high-profile group, because our strength needs to come from being really deeply rooted in the communities that can really disrupt and threaten capital and can force the reforms that we desperately need in this country.
I tend to think that, like, you know, it's very possible to get sort of too clever about sort of strategizing certain things. But as you lay out your vision, right, like there are basically getting some type of universality and decommodifying healthcare begins to give you the power to decommodify other area sectors of our economy. And then, you know, it sort of snowballs, and then you're able to sort of move into democratizing some of these other sectors and firms, as you say. So there is like a sequencing. Are you concerned at all that the sequence is not quite there yet to support a political victory by someone who will attempt to do a lot of these things? In other words, like, is there, when I wake up at 3 a.m, which happens far too often and can't get back to sleep, like the idea of like, okay, Bernie wins, the economy goes south because it's been juiced, and there is a massive pushback because Democrats, obviously Republicans, but even a significant number of Democrats don't want to see these type of reforms. They're still too much entrenched power, and it begins to cut away at the progress that's just made in terms of society, because Bernie ends up being, you know, sort of like stranded on some level because mm-hmm. there's not quite the support amongst the population that needs to be there to actually enact these type of reforms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we need to do right away is, if we have a presidency of someone like Bernie Sanders, then we use the bully pulpit of the presidency. We use executive orders to show people that we're fighting for them. And then certainly there will be other parts of our legislative agenda that we want to push through and we're unable to because of Congress and because the markets are getting riled up and whatever else. But we need to place the blame where it should be blamed. You know, we need to say that, you know, we're in a fight against these interests, and these interests are trying to undermine our program. You know, if you, in a weird way, I think that, you know, there's lessons from the Trump administration. Trump has not delivered to his supporters most of what his supporters wanted, and thank God for that. But he has been able to do certain things, to use a bully pulpit of the presidency to support this really nasty right-wing populist movement that's getting up. And I think we need to use the bully pulpit of executive office to support the real activism on the streets that'll give us more space and more leverage to demand certain things. And probably the best historical example I could give is the example of the 1930s in France. So Léon Blum, the first president back then, prime minister, back then they had prime ministers, of France, who was a socialist, was also a Jew, and he was beaten up about 1-2 months before he took office, and dragged, you know, from a car, beaten up by an anti-Semitic gang. He knew how dangerous the threat of fascism was. But when he took power, he didn't think he could actually administer or do much to advance his vision of socialism. What he thought he was doing was, in his words, occupying power. And the act of occupying power for him was just, I'm going to sit in the seat so the right cannot sit in the seat. Because if the right sits in the seat, they're going to make it harder to advance our agenda and get the things I want 2, 3, 4 years or decades down the road. But instead, what we ended up with was a situation where workers themselves started going on strike, started doing all this disruption to the point that capital was forced to compromise. And Léon Blum was able to get things enacted that summer, like the start of summer holidays and all these other demands. So I think that's the example we have to look for. It's not just what the power of capital. It's how can we summon a countervailing force on the streets?
To what extent, I mean, where does race fit into to all of this? Because, you know, one of the things that one of my catchphrases around here now is it's been for a while that, that you know, to a certain extent, there is a zero sum. There is a zero sum reality in terms of white people, white males losing some of their status within society, not just economic, although that's certainly part of it. But when we look at, like, you know, your average Trump voter, they're not particularly particularly suffering economically. You know, obviously the votes folks who voted against Trump, you know, on average, making less money, struggling just as much. But there is a real sense of loss by white males that they are no longer centered in our society. How do you how does that fit in with your perspective?
So I actually do have to go in about 5 minutes. Okay. I'm just getting signals that I completely have no idea DC geography, and apparently I'm way further from Union Station than I thought. But I think the key thing is to stress to people that we are in fact demanding a program that will help everyone, but will particularly help those who are most oppressed. Will particularly help women. Will particularly help people of color. Will particularly help in this country Black Americans who suffer the most from not having a decent welfare state, from being deprived opportunities and jobs, and so on. But that this gain doesn't come at your expense. So we need to stress the idea that any privilege that a working class person has, say a white male working class person has over other working people, is a relative and not an absolute privilege. And that's really key to stress. And we need to create an environment where we're not just telling people to compare and weigh their privileges, but we're saying, listen, we all need to go together and we need to fight together and we need to make advances together.
I hope that works.
All right. Well,
but I also hope you make your train too. Bhaskar Sunkara, we will do this again. Thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks, we'll put obviously a link to the book. I think we've done that in the past, and we'll have Bhaskar on because I think we still had a lot of stuff left on the table. Interesting in light of what we're looking at in terms of like the what's happening in the Democratic primary at this point.
One thing people might also not know about the book is it's called a manifesto, but there's a lot of history in there too.
Yeah. It recounts all the near misses for a socialist revolution. We didn't even get to the part of Bhaskar's conception of what a revolution looks like.
Yeah, that's
lot less violent than I think the people sometimes associate with.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask him about.
I had it down there. We just didn't. We'll have him back on.
To be continued.
To be continued. And we should say also, you know, the Elizabeth Warren. Well, we'll talk about the WFP in the fun half of the program. I mean, I think there's the WFP endorsed Elizabeth Warren. She had a big rally in New York City yesterday, 20,000 people, decent showing. We will get to that as well. We'll also have a couple of clips from Ben Shapiro in the fun half. Oh, it's going to be so fun. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only get the show commercial free, but you also get extra content virtually every single day. I think, you know, let's just call it every day. I mean, obviously not on the weekends. And maybe there's one or two days where it doesn't happen. For the most part, new content, extra content every day. Don't forget also the AM Quickie. It is available in the Majority Report audio feed, soon to live on its own on its own feed, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And a reminder, this episode brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down into just 15 minutes that you can either read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now, but the beauty is 12 million could be using it and you're still going to enjoy it the exact same way. It's an infinite resource. It has massive and growing library from self-help to business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist.com/majority. Check it out. Today is Tuesday. Michael.
Yes, sir.
Something's going to happen in the studio tonight.
7 o'clock. Actually, first, I should say 6 o'clock pre-stream with a really good Canadian YouTuber, Chris Aviosis, on Canada's elections and the possibility of a North American hemispheric left. But on the main show, we're going to be doing a deep dive into the Israeli elections, what's really driving possible conflict between Iran, Saudi, the Houthis, and what the U.S. role actually is in that, how Trump is sort of an outsized continuation of what already exists, even as he sells Patriot missiles to Bahrain. Emma Viglin is coming through, and we are going to dunk on and turn Joe Biden into a wounded antelope, as well as talking about UK elections and the WFP. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, and grab your tickets to see us in Philly.
Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada, we were going to run our interview with Aaron Bastani about his book, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, but that has been preempted and moved to next week because of the UAW strike. Sean and Andy dropped an emergency episode last night. Surprise, surprise ep, just like Beyonce. And it's really good. I just listened to it. Sean knows so much about labor history. So if you really want to understand what's going on with the UAW strike right now in its proper historical context, check it out. It's free for everyone. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover, James Fenimore Cooper's The Pioneers. It's a really interesting book about how the biggest, actually most land was settled from Native Americans after the revolution than before it. So yeah, people might be surprised to learn that.
I was. All right, quick break. Fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.